Be Digital Radio, it's time for the Daily Service, led by the Reverend Peter Whittaker. Here on FM, we continue our Book of the Week. By the end of the 1920s, the designer Elsa Schiaparelli has launched her fashion house in Paris, and her clothes are selling in America. But the Wall Street crash affects business and demands change. Abigail Thor reads from Elsa Schiaparelli, a biography by Meryl Seacrest.
One of Schiaparelli's greatest assets in the years following the Wall Street crash of 1929 was her intuitive ability to sense the mood. Her instinct was to move away from her predominantly neutral palette of off-whites, greys and black into a splash of colour. These were the most seductive and irresistible colours imaginable, delicious shades of orange, peach, lemon and grenadine. Day dresses might appear in two colours, bright pink with purple and emerald green with bright red. Suits might be shown in deep blue and orange check tweed with blouses in orange silk, or a ski outfit in navy blue with a red and white spotted blouse and a warm red cap. Her fabrics, too, were a constant theme in fashion reporting. "She's got a lot of new crinkly things," one writer reported. "They look so much like the bark of trees, you feel you're going to sprout leaves or acorns or something." Schiaparelli always had a fondness for sleight of hand, and as the Depression deepened even more, parts of the costume became detachable or reversible or had multiple uses. Sometimes ingenuity led to solutions no one else could ever have thought of, such as her speakeasy dress, her salute to Prohibition. It had a kind of pocket or shelf at the waistline in the back of the dress, with perfectly harmless gathers falling from it. The pocket was cunningly designed to exactly fit a handy hip flask. By 1931, exports of French luxury goods, clothes, furs, lingerie, fabrics, were down 50% from the year before. Yet Schiaparelli's business went on growing. Women's Wear Daily wrote, "Again, Schiaparelli reveals the strength of her following among American designers. For the new coat silhouette that she launched at the mid-seasons is not only being widely copied, but is selected as the important influence on which entire collections are being based." Schiaparelli's look was freer, less studied, more flexible than that of other Parisian houses, attuned as they were to great ladies. Her clothes were youthful and had a daredevil swagger. "Dare to be different," she wrote. It would only be another year before Time magazine, that eager arbiter of instant fame, would pronounce her a genius. In February 1933, Schiaparelli returned in triumph to New York, surrounded by newspaper reporters and photographers. She was offered diamond buckles for her shoes if she would agree to walk down Fifth Avenue with a model to advertise jewellery. Someone wanted her to walk a lion across the city on a diamond-studded lead. For an interview she gave in her Savoy Plaza suite, she wore a dark blue, heavily crinkled crepe dress topped by a bright red hand-crocheted jacket with a drawstring tie at the neck. She chose the moment to talk about how versatile the outfit was in this time of austerity and how, by adding a different kind of top, she could completely change the look. Sitting by her hotel window, she said, "There is no question about it. America inspires me. Even the view from this window is thrilling." From then on, Schiaparelli returned to the scene of her inspiration annually. The rest of the time, buyers came to her, usually for the spring and autumn collections, arriving on the SS Europa for 10 days of tension and triumph. Thanks to her contacts, she was finding plenty of people only too eager to show off her latest designs. Sometimes they found her. There was, for instance, the case of a thin, plain-looking girl who was sitting in a corner of her salon one day, wearing dowdy clothes. Something about her interested Schiaparelli, and she offered to help her choose a look. The girl had a certain quality. There was her enchantingly husky voice, expressive hands, and a way of tilting her head that drew attention to a pair of perfect cheekbones. She was Katharine Hepburn, who would one day state that the transformation in Schiaparelli's dressing rooms began her career. Schiaparelli's biggest coup in those years was the endorsement of Daisy Fellows. By the time the two met, Daisy Fellows had become the undisputed leader of society in London and Paris, in fashion, taste, and lifestyle, whom to include and whom to ignore, the very model of a rich and benevolent tyrant. She took delight in wearing black to a wedding and red to a funeral. Her beautifully shaped head, assertive profile, and slim, lithe form were perfectly suited to clothes that trembled on the edge of daring and went right over it. She was perfect for Schiaparelli, and they both knew it. Of all the brilliant decisions Elsa Schiaparelli made in the years before the Second World War, perhaps the most inspired was her decision to work with surrealist artists, and Salvador Dali in particular. There is no record of their first meeting, but it is clear they felt an immediate rapport. If Schiaparelli was the doyen of Paris couturiers, Dali was her male counterpart. Before long, the two of them were sitting at a table together with paper and pencils, designing dresses. One of Dali's recurring themes was that of a woman whose body has been superimposed with drawers down her front, with button pulls in the appropriate places. Dali and Schiaparelli transposed the idea to a suit in navy blue velour, in which descending drawers have become pockets with drop handles of black plastic. Dali was again the source of one of the most famous of all Schiaparelli's gowns, the lobster dress. This crustacean, known for its aphrodisiac qualities, was a recurrent theme for Dali and appears in many guises, particularly a telephone, which had its handset in the shape of a red plastic lobster. The theme was translated by Schiaparelli into a sleeveless evening gown in white organza, with a gently flaring skirt on which a gigantic lobster had been screen-printed, with sprigs of parsley strewn about here and there. The idea that someone would want to waltz away the evening in a dress whose main emblem was something to eat seemed preposterous. But in fact, someone did. Wallis Simpson chose it in 1937, the year of her marriage to the Duke of Windsor, because she thought recent photographs made her look hard and she wanted to look more appealing. Schiaparelli's reach naturally extended to hats, and one of her collaborations with Dali included a hat designed to look like an upside-down, black felt, high-heeled shoe. It had a kind of visor that jutted out over the forehead, the sole, and the heel stuck up out of the ensemble like an exclamation point. Dali loved shoes, and as his way of unwinding was to wear one on his head, the idea made perfect sense to him. After being launched with much fanfare by the fashion magazines, the shoe hat died a quiet death and survives only in a couple of museum collections. One of Schiaparelli's discoveries was an artist called Jean Clément, a self-made genius with a turbulent past, part chemist and part inventor, who was already experimenting in a seemingly minor art, the humble button. For Schiaparelli, the button's seductive uses were secondary to its ability to elicit a frisson of surprise. A perfectly sober dress might, upon inspection, be held together with an exotic variety of shapes, things like acorns, stones, shells, fish, carrots, faces, padlocks, and coins. Buyers were less prepared for the uses she made of another utilitarian object, the zip fastener. Schiaparelli used it anywhere and everywhere, on necklines and side seams, to zip sleeves in and out, close pockets, add or subtract skirts, in short, wherever she could think of them. She writes that she was surprised at the reaction. Astounded buyers bought and bought. Photographs of Schiaparelli in 1934 to 36 show what the effort was costing her. Wearing a simple black V-neck dress with a belt and a white insert at the neckline, She is posed in front of a handsome desk, liberally adorned with flowers, and beside a fireplace and an overflowing bookshelf. She looks, as ever, calm and unhurried. But her new, curlier hairstyle, parted in the centre, does not flatter, and there are dark shadows under her eyes. The demands of success, coupled with her perfectionism, were taking a heavy toll. She was trying to have a private life as well, even though she might claim she was too busy for such things. Long-term relationships with men were out, she wrote. But Gogo told an interviewer that her mother had a 20-year love affair with a Scot who turned out to be the nearest thing I ever had to a father. Elsewhere in her memoir, Schiaparelli refers to my beau Peter. A lengthy search has failed to uncover a beau named Peter. However, it turns out there was not one man in her life, but two, and both were Scotsmen. They were brothers, Alan and Henry Horne. Both were good-looking, but Henry, at about 5'10", was particularly handsome, with a little moustache and always sporting a cigar. He was a wealthy man, one of the most talked about of post-World War I London financiers, although just how he had accomplished this massive juggling act, one newspaper wrote, was the subject of considerable speculation in recent years. It was said that he was professionally charming, especially to wealthy ladies. Schiaparelli had not returned to England since she and de Calore were unceremoniously ejected in 1916. She had no particularly pleasant memories, but she listened tolerantly to Henry as she was urged to open a salon in London. He knew all the top people, an invaluable open sesame for an Italian newcomer like Schiaparelli. Henry's brother Alan owned a large house at 6 Upper Grosvenor Street in London and was now divorced. With his only son away at school, it was established that he did not need such a big house in Mayfair and would be delighted to rent it to Schiaparelli for her first London premises. Everything happened with the madcap logic of a French farce. Henry got bored with Schiaparelli but continued to work for her as her financial advisor. Alan, realising that poor Schiaparelli had nowhere to live in London, bought her a semi-detached house in Lee's Place, Mayfair. Schiaparelli moved into number 5 with her own entrance. Alan took number 5A. The upstairs bedrooms were connected by means of a door cleverly concealed inside a cupboard. She now had the full business attention of resourceful Henry, along with the avuncular approval of the reliable Alan. Once Schiaparelli set up shop at 6 Upper Grosvenor Street, her social life took off with a vengeance. People streamed in and out of the salon all day. She was invited everywhere, and her mind became increasingly receptive. In those years before the Second World War, her imagination was still at its sparkling best. Schiaparelli, formerly baffled by the British character, now saw it in a delightful new light. And dearly I love them, because they are mad, 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 she wrote.
Abigail Thor was reading from Elsa Schiaparelli, a biography by Meryl Seacrest. It's abridged by Libby Spurrier, produced by Joanna Green, and is a peer production for BBC Radio 4. Jane Garvey takes a look at designs for more realistic fashion dolls in a couple of minutes. Basically, they look like real women, not like fairy princesses. But will children like them? Woman's Hour is after the news.
You might have to walk around for 4 days in wet clothes, waiting for those clothes to dry.
Supporting homeless and vulnerable people across the UK.
You are out in the rain, you are deprived of food, you are deprived of humanity because people will just walk by you.
The BBC Radio 4 St Martin in the Fields Christmas Appeal.
I support St Martin's because they don't just dish out the money, they help people to get back on their feet.
You can donate to the Radio 4 Christmas Appeal by calling 0800 082 8284. Calls are free for most landlines. Some networks and mobile operators will charge.